We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Mully and Hall, mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score. 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
Mully and Hall, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. We're delighted to welcome in Northwestern football coach Pat Fitzgerald. He joins us on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Good morning, Coach. How are you?
Morning, Fitz.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate your speaking out, and certainly you attracted attention for what you've been saying here, Coach. And, you know, I got to tell you, I think that it's difficult. It's been a really difficult week. It's been a really difficult few months. And then you top it off with yet another a death of a black man in police custody, and it's you know, it's the anger, the rioting, everything that has happened in Chicago. It's around the country as well. It's very difficult to put into perspective. How are you talking to your players about this?
Well, without a doubt, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with everyone that's being obviously affected, and it's, I think, an incredibly challenging time. But the most important thing from what we've tried to do, at least in our program, is we dedicated Friday's meetings to just listening to our guys and dedicated the entire time to just having a great dialogue, being open, knowing that we're there and willing to listen and try to help and just love on each other. I mean, I think that's, you saw it in what I put out in my tweet, right? You know, we've got to listen, we've got to love, we've got to respect, but ultimately, then there has to be action, and then that's what leaders need to do. We need to step up and not just hope for change, but we got to lead through a challenging time and really lead through our actions. So, you know, just trying to really lead our young men and help them through a challenging time.
Fitz, the tweet that you referenced was on Twitter on Friday, and it was before a lot of other coaches, I think, took advantage of the platform in the way that you did. And you said, in addition to what you referenced, was, quote, "Silence at a time like this is unacceptable and complicit, especially from those who are privileged. Racism cannot be ignored. We can be better. We must be better. We all have a responsibility if we're going to fight systems of oppression." If silence at a time like this is unacceptable, Fitz, what is the right thing to say? How is the right method to get the message out there from people who do have a platform such as you do, as many coaches do?
Yeah, well, I think just be honest and be, you know, be forthright and just be a great listener. You know, I sit in all of our guys' homes and, you know, and or they sit in my office when we are going through recruiting, sit in my family room. And, you know, that's exactly what we want to treat our young men as, if they were our sons. You know, this is a big extended family. And if our son, you know, if one of our three boys were angry and scared and confused, how would you react as a parent, right? I mean, that's been the thought process behind everything we do here as a program. So that's how I've tried to act. And hey, listen, this is not easy. But if being silent is somewhat almost betrayal. I mean, that's kind of what Dr. King said, right? There comes a time when silence is betrayal. So just really working hard to be a great listener, being there for our guys and helping everybody, including our staff members and everybody that I have the opportunity to help and influence, you know, through this time. And hopefully we'll come out in a better place as a society, as a better place as a country. But there's going to be a lot of work that has to be done. It can't just be about hope. It's got to be about action.
Do you know if any of the players are taking part in any of these protests? Have they talked to you about it? And how do you handle that conversation?
Yeah, you know, not direct. We haven't had those direct conversations. But I would, you know, like always, I would advise our guys to make sure they may just make healthy and safe decisions and, you know, to use their platforms the way that they see fit. And I would be 100% supportive of them. And we also have, you know, quite a few of our players' family members that are in law enforcement and, you know, and first responders and part of, you know, how this is in a diverse way and just letting those families know, too, that we're here for them. And it's just, you know, the actions by people that have caused this, it has to be eradicated. It has to be eliminated. I've got very close family friends, very close family members that are in law enforcement, and they're as heartbroken as anybody. And they're great people that just we need to work through and just communicate and listen and be empathetic and be there for each other. But more importantly, we've got to change the actions of people that have really made, you know, members of our communities scared, upset, and, you know, you got to help. You got to just be there to help.
So, Fitz, on Saturday night, as you sort of watched what was happening in Chicago, in a city that it was ugly, it was unrecognizable at times, and as a lifelong Chicagoan, you know, you see what happens Saturday, you see what happens Sunday night in the suburbs. What was going through your mind, and how did you process a range of emotions that you were feeling?
Yeah, you know, just I think probably like most Chicagoans, just you're heartbroken. You know, you're heartbroken that there's members of our community that don't feel safe and they don't feel, you know, obviously in a place that there's anger and I just wish everybody would be safe. That's, you know, the anger and the frustration and the sadness is one thing, but you know, we've just got to be great citizens and you just hope it wouldn't escalate and cross, you know, into a place where people are even less safe or maybe potentially, you know, what's obviously happened with peaceful protests turning into obviously very, very challenging scenes. So you just hope that we can find our way through this, our leaders lead, and we find a way to continue to come together as a community. You know, I say it to our players all the time, you know, I go back to when I was in grade school and high school and you know, there was just a great teaching about coming together as one. And I know our sport is obviously one of the best sports in the world when it comes to taking different backgrounds and different races and religions and socioeconomic backgrounds and coming together in a brotherhood. And that's somewhere where we're going to have to lead as a sport, and I am going to have to lead as a leader of a program. So, you know, that in this time, it's definitely critical that we all step up, stay together, and work through it.
And Coach, I think that, you know, the other element here is we're also in a global pandemic. So you're seeing people out, you're seeing the protest, and you're seeing the anger and you know, the justifiable anger. If you watch that videotape, it just breaks your heart. I mean, a guy is calling for his mother as his life is leaving him. It's horrible. And you watch that, and then you see these protests, and there's also a global pandemic, and you're worried about people being on top of each other and all of the possibility of spreading this disease, and you're risking, you know, your health in order to protest. It's just scary to think about all of the elements at play.
Yeah, there's no question. And, you know, I mean, especially from my perspective, as I've talked to our players, and we have a young man that, you know, grew up right there where Mr. Floyd was stopped and obviously tragically passed away. And, you know, for him, it's so real from an experience standpoint that's exactly where, you know, he grew up. And so I don't know if any of us could ever put into words just how horrific and tragic that video is. And again, coming from someone like me who can't truly grasp and understand from being someone that, you know, is obviously in a role that, that is privileged. And, you know, I just can't even describe it. And so, you know, hopefully our guys are safe. Hopefully Chicagoans can come together and peacefully protest, safely protest, and really work hard to create positive change. And you know, I know the coaching fraternity and coaching boards across that I sit on, I know the AFCA, you know, we're going to work diligently to support our young men through our great game, but we have to step up. We've got to act, and we've got to help our communities and help our states and help our brothers and sisters. And that's the thought process that I know I have. And I look forward to hopefully being a part of some just real positive to find a way out of this.
Fitz, had to share this with you. So yesterday, as we're trying to line up stuff for today's show, Omar Jimenez is a former Northwestern basketball player, played walk-on two seasons, 2012-2013. He was a CNN reporter that was arrested in Minneapolis on Friday and handled himself in a way that made Northwestern University proud and everybody who'd graduated from Medill proud, just the grace that he showed under pressure. And he can't talk yet because CNN has asked to kind of limit the interviews. So in communicating with him, I said, well, okay, he was curious because he wanted to come on. What else we were doing on the show? I told him that we were having you on the show, and I got to go Cats. And I said he loves Fitz. So the basketball players listen to you as well. You have a strong voice there on campus.
Well, you know, it starts on our campus. Leadership has been, you know, we're fully committed. I know our athletic department's fully committed. We've got a, you know, great staff that are leaders in this area nationally and our Engage committee that I'm on in the athletic department. It's just critically important because we all have different backgrounds and we all have different experiences. And if we can come together and just be one, it can solve a lot of issues just by communicating and especially someone in my role listening. And that was tough to see. It was tough to see. I remember, you know, getting to know him well while he was here at Northwestern and just proud of him, proud of the way he handled a very challenging situation not surprised that he did it. So it's the way that he did it. So it's tough. We're going to find positives, and that's, you know, and I'm not trying to be, you know, that guy that always tries to find the positive light, but I think in the leadership role, we've got to find through the darkest hours, you know, you find the brightest light, and hopefully we can come out of this and find a way. And I know where my role is that I can be a part of it. And that's what I hope to do.
Fitz, any chance you get the kids back on campus just to get workouts, to get together? Is there any timetable on any of that stuff?
Yeah, working through it, you know, obviously the phases that we're in the state of Illinois, you know, then trickles down to, you know, locales, you know, i.e. Evanston and then to our campus. So, you know, working through that process, just working with our medical leadership in here at Northwestern, and they'll make all the decisions that we're going to embark on as we move forward through the pandemic. And, you know, like our guys, like we talked about moving through this whole pandemic process, priority is health and safety, and then we'll work through and get ready to play football when it's appropriate. But I feel very confident that our guys have been highly motivated. Their parents and family members have really stepped up and been incredibly supportive. We've tried to do that too, and you know, whenever we can get back together, the priority will be health and safety, and then we'll kind of take it one day at a time from there.
How has it affected recruiting, Fitz?
Well, it's a totally different recruiting process. It absolutely changed completely. You went from having young men and their families on your campus, going out and seeing them in their high schools and watching them work out, maybe play baseball, run track, you know, maybe have spring practice in certain places of the country, you know, to now really having everything virtual. So it's been a little bit surreal. We've got a couple of young men that have committed to our program that haven't physically stepped foot on campus. They've technologically stepped foot on campus. They've zoomed to campus, but they haven't stepped foot on campus yet. But our staff has done a really good job. I think we're in a great place. We've got a great group of guys committed and some other young men that are very close. And, you know, obviously we look forward to just continuing to build those genuine relationships with families that, you know, fit what we're looking for. And it's been great. And we look forward to finishing up the class here. When will that happen? I don't know, but it's going really, really well.
Hey, Coach, we really appreciate you jumping on, appreciate your time, and appreciate your wisdom.
Thanks, Coach.
Well, I appreciate you guys, and let's stay healthy and safe, Chicago. Appreciate you guys. Go Cats. Thanks a lot.
That is Pat Fitzgerald, the head coach at Northwestern. And, I mean, you know, that's what we need. We need guys like him. We need voices like that, David, and people that take responsibility.
There's your semblance of normalcy, Mully, with Go Cats at the end.
All right, we're going to bring in Richard Lapchick next. He is he's a man that that holds wears many different hats, and he's written. I think he's working on his 17th book, David.
Wow!
You know, man that really has great insights, and we'll talk to him about this next. Mully and Haw on the Score. Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. We are delighted to welcome in Richard Lapchick. He joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Richard is the program chair of the UCF DeVos Sports Business Management Program. He has written 16 books, working on a 17th. The president of the National Consortium for Academics and Sports, and the director of the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport. Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Well, we're really hoping you can help us out here because, you know, we're a couple of middle-aged white guys trying to talk about what we're seeing happening around the country. And it is it's not an easy conversation because of the lack of understanding, I think, that we're seeing from people. Help us out. How can people help? What can be done? And has it gotten to a point where we've already missed the opportunity?
Well, I think the opportunity is to sustain the level of concern that has developed in the week of outrage. I think we've seen, you know, if you guys are two middle-aged white guys, I'm an older white guy. I'm turning 75 soon. But I've been watching things like this for literally almost all of my life. When I was a five-year-old kid, I looked outside my bedroom window and saw my father's image swinging from a tree with people under the tree picketing. And I didn't know what it meant, except a lot of people were angry with my dad, who was my best friend as a five-year-old boy. And it was because I would find out later, as the coach of the Knicks, he had signed the first African-American player in the history of the NBA. So that's how far it goes back in my lifetime. And you know, my hope is that, you know, with the age of videos, and we have all these things on record now, and I think that's why the outrage obviously has been as great as it is, and that there were protests in 114 cities yesterday. I don't remember anything that extensive during my lifetime. So what has never changed is it goes on for a couple of weeks, a lot of intensity, and then stops. I think that, you know, we have a young generation of people who have, I think, more passionate feelings about the issue, and now have the documentation of what it looks like in terms of the issue of police brutality. But it's so far beyond police brutality. You know, racism is something that has been ingrained in society to the point that, you know, one of the most startling pictures that I could paint for you and your listeners is that the Forbes list of the 100 wealthy Americans has more aggregate wealth than all 230 the Forbes list of the most 100 wealthy Americans has a greater aggregate get wealth than all 230 million African Americans combined.
Wow.
That's a big gap to overcome. So it's not just about police brutality. It's really about all forms of racism and how it impacts the Black community, including during the coronavirus. I'm sure you and your listeners have read that the impact on the Black community is three times as great as it is on the white community because the health facilities that they generally go to in some of their communities just aren't staffed as adequately and well as health facilities elsewhere. So there's that disproportionate effect. You could look at pretty much any segment of our society and see that disproportionate impact. So I think the goal has to be to sustain that concern and make it a positive, constructive concern. And I think the role of sport, I think the world of sport has a role that it can play in it as well.
What makes the George Floyd incident and the repercussions from it different than the other instances that maybe you lived through or referenced or kind of filed through in your memory as you watched the what unfolded in the 114 cities and cities like Chicago over the weekend?
Well, I think the visual impact of watching a white police officer do what he did, not in a moment of rage, there was no rage there, in a moment of calm, you know, he knelt there with his hand on his hip, looking around. He had people who were shooting the videos of him saying, you know, he can't, not only hearing the victim saying, I can't breathe, but having people telling him, you're killing him, get off of him. And then at various points to see two of the other white officers also kneeling on other parts of his body. The disregard for human life, I think, is what, and over an 8-minute period of time, it's not like something that you saw happen really quickly and then it was over. This was, you know, brutality at its height in a sustained way that you can't turn away from. It is just so compelling and awful. And it's been repeated so many times in the news cycle now that it's emblazoned on the American psyche.
And again, I mean, you're talking about a man who's kind of begging for his life and then calling for his mother. I don't know if you're human and you're not moved by that.
Exactly. You can't not be moved by it.
How do we stop the looting and the violence that is connected with the rioting? Because I think you lose the moral high ground when it turns into kind of this destructive behavior. And I don't know what that anger is like, what that rage is like. So it's hard for me to understand how that transition occurs. But what can be done about it? Obviously you got to stop having these horrible messages coming out of Washington.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that what you just said is really important, that you don't know what this rage is like, an outrage is like, because as a, you know, middle-aged white guy or an older white guy like myself, you know, we've never experienced that. We have, you know, hopefully read about it and learned about some of the disparities in the United States between Black America and white America and other communities of color as well. But we now are saying we don't understand it. So I think that we're opening the door to realizing that this has gone to a level that we really need to deal with and bring about systemic change, because that's what the violence is really calling for. And of course, everybody hopes, or almost everybody hopes, the violence stops as of now, but that rage is so great, I don't know how it's going to actually stop or when it's going to stop. It will stop, but then what do we do after that?
You're an expert on how sports have affected society over the years, and over the weekend we saw statements from Michael Jordan that was powerful. Doc Rivers, I thought, was eloquent. We just talked to Pat Fitzgerald, the Northwestern football coach, and you have seen coaches issue their own statements and teams follow suit. From your perspective, when we talk about sports, and that's what we do here at the Sports Talk Radio Show, when you talk about sports, what role can sports play in our national recovery?
Well, I think, you know, we have a voice in the world of sports that's unique. First of all, it's probably the most diverse community in the United States, with the possible exception of the military. And, you know, sports icons are revered by a lot of people, and they listen to athletes when they speak. Athletes, for most of my lifetime, with the exception of people like Muhammad Ali or Arthur Ashe, were silent, because when they spoke out, they had their careers basically just ended, because the repercussions were that the sports world, the organization of sports, didn't want their athletes to speak out. Now, in the past 5 years, we've seen that athletes are speaking out, and they're being respected for it. I think the death of Muhammad Ali was critical here, because our athletes knew Ali was famous and knew he was kind of beloved, but by the time of his death, they read about all the things he had done over the course of his whole life and realized, I can speak out too. So having that athletic voice, I think, is going to be a really helpful component to it in the future. I think athletes are going to be constructive, as some of the statements you just talked about are. I saw an internal memo from Adam Silver in the NBA talking about having programs in all NBA cities addressing the issue of racial justice, not just police brutality, but racial justice in general. So I think sports can come up with a way. It's obviously not the solution, but I think it can be helpful, because sport, I think more than anything else, can help unite people at times of trials and tribulations like we're in now.
Sport is a meritocracy where if you're good at it, you are kept on it. I mean, you are a lot of the economic and racial inequalities aren't as evident in the sporting world as they are elsewhere. And yet they're still, I mean, you look at Colin Kaepernick and what happened because of his protest, and how he was kind of no longer needed in the NFL. And we're hearing people suggest that it would be a good idea for the Minnesota Vikings to bring him in as a player, because it would help to somehow balance what's going on in Minneapolis. I'm confounded by that idea. I don't know how one thing makes up for the other, but I do know that when the NFL talks, and when they make a statement as they did yesterday, you have to see it within the context of fighting against protests and people kneeling over the national anthem, and it just rings hollow a little bit coming from that league.
Well, I think that's been the strength of the NBA, is in the aftermath of the Colin Kaepernick kneeling and the Goodell finally taking a stand after President Trump said, fire all these guys. He didn't quite use that terminology, but that the NBA decided to do something constructive and positive and support the players in their protests right from the beginning. And I think that is why the NBA is kind of has that level of credibility. I hope that the NFL can do some constructive programming. And I was at the Super Bowl this year, not at the game, but at events around it. And there were so many NFL-sponsored programs on social justice that it was really heartening to see that, because it was the first time I had actually seen it. So hopefully, you know, the NFL is realizing that they can have a really positive, constructive role in this terrible crisis that we face today.
When people ask you difficult questions about what to do next and how they can help, and how hopeful are you in talking to them and answering them? Do you encourage them? Are you, based on your experience, you have seen this cycle, you know, happen before, and people kind of come out of it. Are you encouraged for any reason, or are you, what do you say?
Well, you know, I've been doing this for probably 60 of my 75 years, and there has to be some level of optimism that change can come about for somebody to do it that long. So I talk about that. I talk about, you know, I think this generation, the people who are shooting those videos, have a feeling of egalitarianism that probably previous generations haven't had as widespread a way. And they also have the video camera. That's the game changer right now, that you can't, you know, I can't say something abstract about the reality of racism and it's a horrible statistic and you can forget it. I don't think most people are ever going to be able to forget what they saw on the street that day with that police officer on the neck of George Floyd.
Is there anything that we can do to help our own society? Is there anything that the normal person can do, you know, talk to your children about everything you're saying? I don't know what it could be, but do you have any ideas?
Well, I think talk to your children is part of it. Find some social justice issue that you know, is compelling to you, and there's so many of them out there, and become active in it, encourage your children to be active in it. That doesn't mean you have to go out and protest in the street. It means you could send a financial contribution to them or volunteer for them, or, you know, there's so many different avenues that we can become quote unquote activists in whatever way fits our own lifestyle and our own belief system. But don't stay on the sidelines. Get involved.
It's a great
Thanks
message.
Very much for your
Thanks
time.
So much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. Take care.
Wow. It's really just it's fascinating and horrible all at the same time, David.
Smart guy, simple advice, and sound logic. You know, he is somebody who is, as he pointed out, boy, been through things like this before. And come out of it, and hit that perspective valuable as well. I didn't realize he was 75 years old, Molly. 17 books is that's a lot of. I know some people haven't read 17 books.
Don't be taking shots at any individuals. All right, we're gonna close it down. We're gonna talk to Lawrence Holmes. We're gonna talk to our colleague next, Molly and Haw on the Score. Molly and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Lawrence Holmes is our colleague at The Score, and you can listen to him at noon today. He is also a professor of media at DePaul, and you see him on NBC Sports Chicago. Good morning, Lawrence. He joins us on the El Pamonte Ford Hotline at El Pamonte Ford in Melrose Park.
Hey, Lawrence.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Wow, what an awful weekend, Lawrence. You know, just awful to watch it on television, to see everything that's happened. I don't know. Your perspective is totally different than ours, but I don't know anybody that could have watched that George Floyd video and not feel. I know it's outrage, but it's also almost like the saddest thing ever. When that went on for as long as it went on, and you hear him telling the cop with his knee on his neck that he can't breathe, and then calling for his mother. I mean, I gotta tell you, that tore me up. And then to see the response and everything that's happened over the last week, it's just it's just sort of taken the curtain and pulled it back on everything that is going on in this country.
Yeah, and Molly, I'm glad that you aren't running away from that part of it, because I think that over the last couple of days that's the part that seems to get washed out, that everyone's worried about the logistics of protest and whether there are provocateurs that are trying to co-opt movements, that are trying to really just ask for something that's very simple, and that's police reform, the end of police brutality. To me, that's an issue where I feel as if it really shouldn't have any sort of dividing line among race or socioeconomic status, that we should all be able to look at police brutality. And in the case of George Floyd, go, things have got to change. And I've found it frustrating that you often get clapped back with, well, there are a lot of good cops out there. Obviously, there are a lot of good cops out there. But I challenge all of those good cops to step in. That if there were good cops that were in front of George Floyd, they should have stopped him from being murdered on the street. But what we saw is three police officers holding a man down, and one holding a man down by his neck with a knee on his neck, while another police officer just stood there and stared. And if police forces across the country aren't going to police themselves, then the rest of us have no chance against them. If there's a fear inside of those police departments that they can't speak up for fear of retribution, then there's no chance for any of this stuff to get better. The cycle is going to repeat. And we saw it was in Seattle, I believe, where there was an officer that was doing a similar restraining hold against, and the other officer moved their knee off the person's neck to their back. Now, I don't know if that happens if there wasn't such of a spotlight put on what happened in Minneapolis, or if that officer didn't realize that he and his partner were being filmed. Those are the things that have to be addressed. Those are the things. And the other things, and I'll just say from my standpoint, I've grown really tired of Fraternal Order of Police spokespeople dog whistling whenever their members are called to the carpet for their lack of responsibility and care with the citizens that they are supposed to serve and protect.
Lawrence, you used the term police brutality, and I think that is exactly appropriate, and it applies here. But you don't hear a lot when you hear people talking about the systemic change is sort of the code word, and that's the way they talk around this. Does that bother you? Have you noticed that? And have there been other ways that this has been talked about? Because I know that you are, you know, you study this stuff and you pay close attention to this stuff. Other things that have stood out to you that have been problematic in your mind?
Yeah. You know what, David? And it's like I was saying, the job of being a police officer is so hard. And the people that decide that they want to do it, almost all of them come into it being people who are brave, that they're a little bit different than most people, that they run towards danger while other people run away from it. But with the things that they've seen, I'm not sure that these officers get everything they need as far as mental health training. I'm not sure that I am sure that they're not paid enough. And I'm not sure that they get what they need as far as being as active in the community. And we hear this all the time from politicians that is something that they're going to try and do, but it always seems to get lost in the wash once the politicians come to power. And I want them to be as safe as they can be. I just want them to make sure that they are trying to take care of people that once those people are in custody, that there's no need for some of this activity. And it breaks my heart that we're still in this place, that we're still watching citizens die at the hands of police. And those are the things that I want people to care about. And I want police officers to understand that we understand how hard their job is. But when I hear the type of rhetoric that comes from FOP spokespeople, it makes it feel as if it is very us against the community. And in the case of Illinois' FOP spokesperson, it feels like it's the police versus black people. And those are things that have to stop. That's why there is mistrust amongst the black community and law enforcement. That it's not universal. I mean, I was talking to a police officer last week while, you know, down at Apostolic Church, they were doing a food drive, and this officer was more than willing to help out and help divert traffic and keep people safe while all of this stuff was going on while dealing with a pandemic. I mean, those are things that I think that do need to have a spotlight put on them. But in the meantime, those officers that see officers doing bad, they have to be rooted out. They have to be held responsible, because it makes all of them look bad. And it's not a profession that can allow for that. In other areas of our economy, there can be bad salespeople, bad radio hosts. There can be, you know, bad electricians, because most of those people don't have their hands on someone's life. And that's what our police officers do. They have the power to take life away. So if good officers aren't doing the job of not just stopping those bad officers from taking life, but getting them out of their police forces, then we're doomed as a society. And you can see politicians buckling to the power of the police lobby. Over the last 72 hours, you've seen it. You've seen our mayor here in Chicago, who ran on a message of reform, who ran on that. Like, that was her big thing. I talked to Lori Lightfoot in person in Hyde Park about her ideas about reform. And what we saw from her was using the tactics of her predecessors, the ones that she ran against, the ideas that she ran against, because she didn't have a better option or plan to keep the city safe. Those are the things that frustrate me. And David, when you texted me this morning, I had just come back from a ride around the neighborhood. And, you know, I did kind of a concentric circle around Hyde Park, Woodlawn, Kenwood, Jackson Park this morning. I'm really encouraged by how many peaceful protests there were. There was a great march down Cottage Grove. I was discouraged by the damage that was done to the Walmart, to the Walgreens on Cottage Grove, to Kimbark Plaza on 53rd. And it's hard to figure out what to do with all of this stuff. But at the root of it is what people want, what good people should want, is an end to police brutality. And we should be giving voice to all of those officers who try. We should be supporting them that try their hardest to do the job the right way and to get rid of with no remorse the officers who don't.
He's Lawrence Holmes. You can listen to him at noon, starting at noon today. And Lawrence, you know, obviously, I grew up on the South Side. I've lived in the city for the majority of my life, but I've never been afraid. I've always had a healthy fear of Chicago cops, but I've never been afraid that I was going to be pulled over because of my race. I've never been afraid that I was going to be mistreated because of my race. A totally different life experience than what a lot of people have gone through. Can you tell us of your own personal experiences? Have you had a talking to about how to behave? Did your parents have to talk to you? I mean, it has nothing to do with how you're behaving, but what you have to do to get through it.
Molly, I was talking with some people last night. Our friend Jason Goff did this incredible kind of town hall Zoom, and we were talking on it last night. I'll be 45 on Saturday. I went to go see my parents Saturday afternoon, hung out with them, and my mother wanted me to make sure that I got home safe. And she wasn't talking about worrying about getting through the South Side, worrying about my neighbors, and worrying about protests or looting. She's worried about the police. I'm a grown man, and she's still worried about that. My interactions overall with Chicago police officers has been, I would say, positive, especially in my neighborhood, the ones that are on the beat in Hyde Park, ones that work at the University of Chicago. I would say it's overall positive. I have had incidents where I'm in the suburbs, and I was telling the story last night. Like, I was driving around with a friend in the suburbs. She happens to be white. We got pulled over, and this officer asked her if she was in the car of her free will. Like, there's a level of fear that ends up happening when any person of color sees those flashing lights behind them. And it's not even – and I think that it happens for anyone. I think that, you know, if you guys were getting pulled over, that there would be some fear. You're like, well, what did I do wrong? You know, that sort of thing. But I think that it's amplified when you're a person of color and you're worried if you're going to survive the encounter. And it's not – it's not always about, well, make sure you follow the directives of the police officers. That doesn't even seem to matter anymore. It's just a very convenient trope for people who want to accept when people are being brutalized by the police. And what I've always thought was fascinating is the lack of empathy for those that might be on the other end of a political spectrum. If we think of American politics in a U-shape, where people who are on the left and people on the right are closer together on issues of authoritarianism, for example, that those people, when it comes to their rights, they want to be able to express their rights, and they don't want the government to tread on them. When I say that I don't want the government to tread on me in the way of police brutality, I don't understand why they can't see it that way and say, hey, you know, this is an authoritarian act and we shouldn't support this because that person's skin color is different or because they're from the inner city. We should be supporting that no police department or officer or government should be able to tread on its people by making people targets while they're just trying to live their lives.
Lawrence, we both make our living talking about sports. This is a sports talk radio station. When you go on your show, these are great points, and they're terrific. It's terrific insight. How do you see sports playing a role in the recovery from this if you think that sports can help with the process?
David, I honestly don't know. Like, I've been racking my brain since yesterday on what my show even looks like today, and to tell you the truth, I'm still not sure. What it looks like today. And Herbie and I are going to go through some of this stuff and try to figure out whether this is one of those days where we're even talking about sports. I know that you guys have done a good job today of bringing on different voices to try and work through this. I guess it's encouraging in some respects where you're seeing a lot of athletes and a lot of white athletes start to really take notice of what's happening and echo some of the sentiments of their black and brown counterparts in this regard. Like, that's encouraging. What's discouraging is that there are still a lot of leaders of men, especially in the college ranks, that are more than willing to tell you how they feel about everything except when it comes to issues of race. And that's disappointing. You know, a Dabo Sweeney will get on TV to tell you everything that's wrong with America except for something like this. You know, like that. Those are the things that Mike Gundy will get on TV and get in front of a conference call and tell you everything that's wrong with today's youth, what's wrong with American youth. But he'll be silent when it comes to issues of race and power and class. Those are the things that I hope that If those people are uninformed, that they do listen to their players. And instead of just saying we're going to have a dialogue, have an actual dialogue about these things and understand that they're not the ones speaking from a place of authority on this, that their experience does not qualify them to speak from a place of authority, and give their athletes an opportunity to educate them, that education is supposed to be reciprocal, that they're supposed to be able to learn, and the best coaches are the ones that do learn from those experiences and then can apply it. So that's where I hope sports goes with this. But, I mean, I was frustrated as anybody seeing that statement from the NFL, because I'm just sitting there going, right. You know, when there was someone who was trying to bring attention to this, you as a league decided that you were going to blackball them. There's someone that was actually doing the most peaceful type of protest, who has been blackballed from the NFL and then defamed on top of it. You've had people just go into, he's not good at quarterbacking, he's not this, he's not that. And Colin Kaepernick has been out here in he's been in Chicago. He's been at the DuSable Museum in Chicago talking to people about their rights. So there's a lot of ways to go, and I'm trying to work through my anger and my sadness with the way things are. I am encouraged by the people who reached out to me over the weekend personally, like the friends of mine that reached out to me, like that means something. People who said to me, I can't understand where you're coming from, but I understand that you're hurting. I would suggest that anyone who has friends that are people of color, that those type of sentiments go a really long way. That when you have people that just care about your well-being enough to go, I don't totally get it, but I'm willing to listen and try and understand it, it makes a big difference. And I think that that's where all of us can start to learn from each other. And I appreciate you guys giving me the platform to talk on your show.
Well, we're delighted to have you on, Lawrence.
And thanks,
we'll
Lawrence.
Be listening at noon. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Talk to you later.
That's Lawrence Holmes. Wow. Want to thank everyone for calling and texting and emailing.
Most of all, thank you for listening.
Yeah, our thanks to our crew. Thank you, Dustin Rhodes.
Boo.
Thanks to Kevin. Wow, tough
crew. Boo.
And Ray, bless you, sir.
Kirby.
Thank you, Ray.
Always nice to Ray. David, have yourself a great day. We'll be talking through everything. It's Mullion Hall, Chicago
great day,
Sports Radio. 6-7 to the score.
This segment brought to you by CarX Tire and Auto.
End the story.
I see you soon, baby.
If it is to be said, so it be. So it is.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.